From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in 1991. The first Gulf War had begun, and a local teacher, George Dardis, was disturbed by the images he saw on his television. He felt complicit in a war that he did not support. He was moved to make a change in his life. He decided he wanted to learn Arabic, for example. But he realized at the age of 50, he didn't know a single Muslim. There are 1,300,000,000 Muslims in the world, and George felt somehow isolated from them. So he went on to learn the language. He's written a number of books, including a book that I've been reading this week called Do We Worship the Same God? Comparing the Bible and the Quran. And here in 2015, some of the questions that might have arose in George's mind 24 years ago are more relevant than ever as the world wrestles with the question, what does it mean to be a Muslim? Do we have religions of violence in this world? What do the actions of some ostensibly true believers really mean for the larger population? George is here. We're going to talk about this and a lot more. And I want to start by first of all, welcoming you and thank you for writing the books that you have. I've been very moved by them, so thank you.
Thank you. Well, thank you, Evan, for having me.
1991, you saw those images on television, and you've written, and I've read that you've thought, my tax dollars are supporting a war. It's essentially being carried out in my name as an American, and it doesn't feel right.
Well, yes, but the bigger dimension is my baptism in 1983 as a Catholic Christian. That's really the key to it all, because I, at that point, came into out of the cold, so to speak, from a kind of an academic narrowness into a belief that the world was really God's and that I, as a creature of that world, as one of the created beings of that world, owed it to be in sympathy with all of that creation. And I was guided into that through my baptism by the example of Thomas Merton, the Trappist monk who did so much to help us understand nonviolence, was a major leader in helping us understand what a creative response to the violence at that time might be to the Vietnam War. Example of Dorothy Day, the Berrigan brothers. So that was the Catholicism that I embraced as a newly baptized person, trying to open myself up for the first time to a larger world beyond my own small academic one. So in that context, in 1991, when my wife Peggy and I were watching the TV and this horrible display of military arrogance. Now, this is my point of view as a baptized, newly baptized, still newly baptized Christian, watching all of this and horrified by the way that humanity was being treated as a kind of a shell game of, that was the first time we heard about surgical strikes and all the rest of it, how easy it was to kill people. And I said out loud, my wife heard it, I'm complicitous in this because I'm supporting it with my tax dollars. And also because of my ignorance, that with all my fancy education, I knew nothing about Islam. I didn't know even where Iraq was on the map. I did not know a single Muslim at my age. How could that be? I'm complicitous. I'm going to do something about it. I'm going to learn Arabic. But I'm afraid, Evan, part of that tone of that was a bit boastful. I thought that was a kind of a nice thing to say. It kind of eased my conscience a little bit. But part of that devil in me was saying, well, you don't really have to act on that because how can you learn Arabic in Rochester?
Kind of the thing that people who I might say, well, you know, I'm a little concerned about what I'm contributing to the atmosphere of this world, but I drive a Prius, George. So.
Good. Yeah, that'll take care of
that
it.
That takes care of it.
Or I drink bottle of water, whatever it is. You know, some token that you can really say, pat yourself on the back for. So there was no way of my thought of learning Arabic, so I let the whole thing drop and felt okay about it, I guess. My wife and I took a little course at the Colgate Divinity School, which is very good, by Professor Emil Homeran, that gave us a little background in Islam, and that seemed to be sufficient to supply what I needed to make my conscience feel a little better. But then almost over a year later, it was in, I think it was in the fall of 1993, my wife Peggy brought home from our cooperative food market a flyer for Arabic lessons. And they were to be given at our local Islamic center over in Islamic, at Westfall Road. It had just been built a few years before. And she put it on my dinner plate after I'd come home, and I looked at that. And she had heard what I'd said about learning Arabic, and she said, well, maybe he'd be interested in doing it. Now, here, maybe this is an opportunity, maybe not. I don't know if he's still interested. She put it there. For me, it was, my heart sank. I still remember this because I thought, oh, my God, I may have to go through on my promise.
You may actually have to do it.
But, Evan, I thought there was a way out because I saw that the final date for signing up or the beginning of classes was within a couple of days. And that little devil in me kept saying, Muslims would call it a shaitan, a little whisperer, they call it. He said, don't worry, George, because everybody will have signed up and the classes will be filled. You can't do it. Sorry, you made a good try, good faith effort. You just have to call up and they'll tell you their classes are full. I called up. No, you're welcome. Please come over. So there I was. My bluff had been called. I had to go over to that Islamic center. And I still like to remember and want to remember that trip over there in that afternoon or evening because it helps me sympathize with people who are frightened about Islam. And those are the days before the Islamophobic industry was still very new. They hadn't really gotten into gear the way they are now. But I found myself, and I remember this, so full of Islamophobic images. The building frightened me, for instance. If you ever notice it on Westfall Road, it's not parallel with the road itself, like all other buildings should be. So what's with that? And what about those domed windows and the minaret at the back? What is all that? And I remember the fear I felt as I went to the door to knock on it and wondering what would happen to me. I don't think we had the word terrorist then so much. And I wouldn't have put it that way, but maybe assassins? Or my imagination was going a little bit wild. Well, the door opened up, and this very gentle human being invited me in. It became a very, very close friend, Dr. Mohammed Shafiq. He's now the director of the Hickey Center over at Nazareth College, invited me in. Would I take off my shoes? Well, sure, yeah. I had no idea why I was doing that, but I was glad to do it. I was upstairs within a couple minutes in a class of 30 other Muslims, Muslims, who were all studying the Arabic because they needed to know the language of their faith, since only about one-fifth of Muslims are Arabic speakers.
You were the only non-Muslim?
Yeah. Yeah, so from knowing no Muslims after all those years, suddenly I knew 30, and we were all in it together. That was the start.
And you learned Arabic.
Well, here's what happened. It was traveler's Arabic that he was teaching. You know, how to get to the airport, how to, ask for a restroom, all those kinds of, you know, did it rain today? Will it rain today? Has it rained? It might rain, like all those things. And I realized after a while, I really didn't see a purpose in learning that. I mean, how did that answer the guilt and the sense of shame I felt for what had happened with that Gulf War and was still continuing, you know? But then I realized, because what happened was, this is the Muslims would disappear during the class for their Asr prayer, just before sundown. And they would politely say, well, George, we have to go. We'll be right back after we finish the sujood downstairs in the prayer area. So I'd be left alone. And I would kind of like listen to them and look around at some of the Qurans that were lying around, which I slowly began to be able to read once I'd begun to get a feel for the alphabet. And I remember there was a kind of a revelatory moment where at one point I began to, as they were praying downstairs, I understood a whole line from the prayer. And I realized, they are praying, and it's beautiful. I want to be closer to that. One thing led to another, and I eventually asked Dr. Shafiq if there's some way that I, as a Christian, because there was never any question of converting here, if I, as a Christian, could learn the Quran. And he said, I didn't. At this point, I was fearful that he'd say no. All of my fears would be reversed at this point. And he said, sure, we can do it. And he set me up with a wonderful teacher, a black man. And here's another strange thing. This was this man who became my Quran teacher for the next 2 years. We'd sit in the back of the masjid, the prayer area at the Islamic Center, for the next 2 years on Saturday afternoons, studying the Quran line by line together. This person of color became my first friend, first black African-American friend I'd had since high school. How could it be that I had to go to a mosque to reunited with my black brothers and sisters in this world? And so that's part of what I'm trying to say about how this whole experience became baptismal in the sense of it opened me up and opened me to a world much beyond my tiny little one of white bread kind of conservativeness.
Okay. And so throughout then, well, I was going to say throughout the 1990s leading up to 9/11, but I guess we should back up and say, as you learned and built these relationships and strengthened these relationships, you came to embrace the idea of wanting others to learn about what we didn't know, the Islamic faith, etc. But obviously, things changed in many, many ways on 9/11. If they hadn't in the Gulf War, 9/11 had to be very, very painful for you. On, I mean, it was painful for all of us.
Yeah.
But kind of take me through what, how it changed for you in terms of the way you interacted with the public, with other folks, etc. Take me through that.
Yeah. Well, first thing I have to say a little bit more about my experience at the Masjid. About a couple years after I'd been taking lessons with my friend Sadiq, my teacher, I came into the mosque one day and I heard, well, he had been teaching me in the school boy girl way, a very kind of methodical recitation of the Quran for correctness, correct vocalization of the vowels and the consonants, which are hard for you and me to pronounce because you use different parts of the mouth and the throat. But but chanting the Quran in the correct way, the amount of time you use in an open vowel, all those kinds of things, very mechanical, you might say.
Sure.
So I came into the masjid one day, and I heard some of the verses that we'd just been learning sung, chanted in this beautiful voice. And I came in, I asked Dr. Shafiq, what's going on? Who is that? And he said, he explained it's a qari. Like a, we'd call it a cantor, I guess, a person whose life is spent memorizing the Quran and then to learning to chant it in these beautiful tones that both reflect the tradition of the chant and also the free expression of faith on the part of the chanter. And I was able to sit down with that particular person and just try to match voice with him, and it was an extraordinary experience because he knew New English, this particular Qari. He'd come from Pakistan to give lessons, and I knew no Urdu, so the two of us only had the Quran in common. But for a couple of weeks, we sat together, and he tried to teach me some of what it meant to vocalize it in this way. And here's what a key thing, which was that I realized how truly beautiful the Quran is, why people love it, why it is a religion of such compelling beauty that you would want to follow it into death, and in the sense of you would believe so strongly in God that you would want to be, your belief would constantly be reinvigorated by your sense of the beauty of what you were receiving, the form of the gift of God's grace. I'd say it's very comparable to the gift of the Eucharist for a Catholic Christian like myself. Very similar kinds of inner emotional feeling. So that made me understand exactly, or at least the best as I could, why people were Muslims and what about this faith made people so in love with it. So anyway, but back to your question, how things changed with 9/11. I wrote an article in 1995 or 6, I guess, for Commonwealth magazine called When a Christian Chants the Quran, because I was puzzled as to what had happened to me. I was not trying to convert to Islam, and yet I'd fallen in love with it. But what did that mean? How could you be in two places at the same time? And I knew no example of a person who'd gone through and entered into that other religion at the depth in which I had. And I was trying to find out what that meant for me and for others. And did other people approve of it? What did it mean? And generally, that article got a good reception, but I was still left wondering, well, is this what I really am? Is this a satisfactory answer to the original question about I'm going to learn Arabic? Is this a way of kind of coming to terms with what happened in the Gulf? And I puzzled about that for a number of years. And I remember when I would give talks about Islam after that period, before 9/11, the reaction of people to those talks was as if I had learned a kind of an interesting hobby like stamp collecting, and I was sharing that with them, and they were very wonderful with me, and they were very, they get polite applause, and it's interesting that you did that. But I was left thinking, well, is it only interesting? I mean, what if is it just been a hobby? But 9/11 changed that completely, and that's the answer to your question, I think, because then I saw that the gift I'd been given, that is the gift of being able to understand the great beauty of the Quran, now had a purpose, that it could really serve as a tiny counterweight to what had been destroyed by 9/11.
Right? And so you had seen the world move very quickly. There's always going to be prejudice, I suspect.
I think there will be, Evan. Yes, I'll bank on that.
But you saw the world turn very sharply to making quick judgments, pronouncements, persecuting people who have done nothing wrong. And I'm not saying that none of the questions and fear were justified. I mean, that was horrifying and tragic for everyone. But you had to try to decide for yourself, how do you talk to people who don't believe that the core of this religion is peaceful and beautiful?
Yeah.
What did you do?
Well, I wrote a book first, giving my personal response, more or less of what I've been saying, talking to the level at which I've been talking so far about the personal piece, how I got to be where I am and why, how I passed, I call it passing over to Islam, and I got that language from a theologian, John S. Dunn, who talks about how we are really obliged to pass over to the other and then return with new perceptions because we've entered into that other space. Something like, I bet what you do on this program, you must have to do something like this with your guests. Even if you don't agree with them, you have to be able to sympathize with them and to try to understand their point of view.
I certainly hope so.
Well, you do that, and that's why I'm not trying to pat you on the back. I have no reason for trying to do that, but you're very successful at this. People love you, and they feel that you really do enter into their space when they're dialoguing with you in this situation. And I feel that now when I'm talking with you now. But you must come home from that experience enriched by it. You must feel larger from
it. No question.
Well, that's kind of what I'm trying to talk about here, that feeling of moving out of yourself to come back home. And John S. Dunn, in his talking about passing over and returning to the self, talks about this as a necessary action of the whole person to become truly authentically human. And that as a baptismal action is exactly what I'm trying to reenact in my own life and have been trying to do. Anyway, your question though was what happened when after 9/11, when I began to felt I had to write these books. Well, when I give talks about Islam after 9/11, the atmosphere completely changed. As you can imagine, it was no longer, I was
curious.
No longer,
it was more volatile or
well, it was
vitriolic.
Yeah, I mean, there was nobody. I was no longer pursuing an interesting hobby. I was, and for some people, I was dealing with a very dangerous thing, and I was I got into trouble sometimes. I mean,
did some think that you were an apologist?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or I was called a dupe on several occasions. You know that I.
You don't really understand what this
right,
is
right, and they're using you, these people. And I learned so much about nonviolence, and I had nonviolent training before that about how to deal with people who are attacking you in a hostile way, how to absorb that punishment in order to reach out into their humanity. Because at first, when I would be, this wasn't always the case, but it did happen more than once. A person became very angry with me, and I began to try to argue with them. I would say, well, don't you realize that it's not like that? And here's why. I'd say, Islam is not like that, and let me explain to you. And I'd go into kind of a professorial sort of mode and try to show that the Quran really didn't say that or this and that and the other. And it did no good because the person's whole being had been poisoned by the media's portrayal of Muslims. And they were beside themselves with fear and rage and all of it. So how to respond? I fell back on the fact that I am a Catholic clergyman. I'm a permanent deacon of the Diocese of Rochester. I fell back on, I'm not falling back, this is a great gift and great resource. I tried to be with them in their anger, to try to ease them through it so that they could come back to their own humanity. Because people in that situation are so upset, they can't, they're not thinking straight. They're not able to really go through any, they're using the language of thought, but they're not able to do it, if you see what I mean.
And what I want to do with our remaining time with George Jardis, again, who's the author of Do We Worship the Same God? Comparing the Bible and the Quran. I want to talk about some of where you see the misperceptions coming from. And we cannot possibly get through everything we want to here. I will open it up later in the hour for phone calls. I'm going to take one now just because I know Chris in Rochester wanted to kind of jump after a point that you had made earlier. So we'll take a call now. This is Chris in Rochester. Go ahead, Chris.
Yeah. I wanted to ask the speaker, did he say when he was talking about the beauty of the Quran that he could see why people would want to follow the scripture to the death?
Oh, yes, I did say that, Chris, and I'm sorry. I you know, that's one of those things you wish you had framed a little bit better. I meant that...
Yeah, let me say, I think I understand why you said that, but I could very, very easily see how people who are not sympathetic to the overall point you're trying to make being on the show could take that as, you know, like a terrible justification for what's happening in the Middle East now, you know, with ISIL and, you know, the stuff that they do. You see what I'm saying?
Oh, sure. I
was just rather worried that you put it that way.
Yeah, well, I'm worried too, and I wish I hadn't. I meant that, just as with my own Catholic Christian faith, to feel God's beauty and the gift of faith enables one to face the one's own death in a way that one can't do otherwise, I don't think. And that's all I meant about it. These religions are all about God's mercy and about God's protectiveness, whether we are alive or dead. And our death merely introduces us into a different relationship to God. That nothing separates us from God. That's all I meant. And yeah, Chris, you're right. And I'm glad you called, because that's a misunderstanding that I'm sorry about. And but I think you've helped a little bit. I hope you have. I hope that has been clarified.
Sure, absolutely. George, so now we look at, well, this week we see a Jordanian pilot put in a cage, lit on fire, and murdered by the group that calls itself ISIS. Or I don't like saying ISIS. I like they're the group that calls themselves ISIS, because I know that some feel the appropriation of the term Islamic is obscene to begin with. But their justification for that action, they point to passages in the Quran in which they talk about the use of fire, the symbolic nature, the way they view this as honoring their mission. Now, let me ask you, do you view them as sincerely thinking they are carrying out the tenets of their faith, or do you think that they have other motives and that they are using faith as an excuse?
Well, I can't pretend to be inside their heads to know what they're doing, what they're thinking. It's clearly the case, though, that if I'm right, and that Islam is a religion of beauty, and I believe I am right, and that it is God's gift to humankind to follow God through the voice of the Quran, then what they're doing is absolutely a travesty. There's just no question about it. And they're either insane and psychopaths, or whatever term we would use, or they're also motivated by political considerations and by strategies and by thoughts about how they can manipulate public opinion so that they can maintain themselves in power. Because that's what the situation is in that part of the world. It's a tremendous, tremendous power vacuum caused, I would say, in a large part by our own invasion of Iraq in 2003, which destroyed the fabric of that whole country. And has allowed groups like that to spring up in that kind of barren political environment. And they're crazy, we might say, and extreme, but I think it's better to look at them as looking around for some way to authenticate themselves as truly terrible forces to be reckoned with, because that's what it is.
In George's book, Do We Worship the Same God?, I learned for the first time, and you talk about George feeling at the age of 50 all the things he didn't know. There's a lot that I don't know, my goodness. And I learned about what jihad is, what it is not, what greater jihad and lesser jihad are. And by the way, we almost never hear that made with any distinction. I don't know. I don't hear it in the media. I don't know if you do. The term infidel, what it is and what it is not, and the way it might be characterized. And we're going to get to that in our second half hour, because I think those are important. Of all the important parts of this book, those are important things to understand, especially because we hear those terms on a daily or at least a weekly basis in the media. George does write in his book that about terrorism. And let me quote George, and then I want to hit on a passage that a lot of times we hear used to justify violence. You write that and I'm trying to make sure I've got, I can shorten this here, that essentially the Quran and the Hadith explicitly condemn terrorism and any such behavior, and Muslim tradition has upheld the condemnation. Then you point out, and I think rather certainly helpfully, that in the Quran there is, and help me with the pronunciation, Surah Al-Tawbah Repentance, 9:1 through 9:16. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. In the middle of these passages, there are a couple of lines that are pulled out, often pulled out and discussed and used as, well, look, it's a religion of violence. I'm going to read the one line first, and then I'm going to try to read it in more context, if we could. The line that people often hear is this: fight the idolaters wherever you find them. Seize them, beset them, besiege them, wait for them in ambush. That's the line I often hear. You hear that as well.
Yeah.
And people say, well, come on, George Dardis. That's a religion of beauty and peace.
Yeah.
The broader context, because when we hear that passage, it's to say they're telling true believers in the Islamic faith, you need to go out and find the non-believers and ambush them, attack them, maybe kill them, etc. What we don't hear is that this passage is contained within a longer set of passages that talks about the real importance of trying to simply convince non-believers to believe with you and to honor God with you. And there isn't actually any word about killing that I'm seeing here. So let me go ahead and read a little bit, and then we'll talk about this. So this is from those same passages with more context. Quote, all this shall happen except to those idolaters with whom you have made alliances, and who since then have never betrayed you in any way, nor given aid behind your back to enemies. But when the 4 months are over, and George can explain why 4 months is an important time frame, but when the 4 months are over and the other party has persisted in its treachery, then fight the idolaters wherever you find them, seize them, beset them, besiege them, wait for them in ambush. Yet still, if they repent, if they observe daily prayer, if they give to the poor, then clear the way for them. Remember that God is all-forgiving, most merciful. And if one of the idolaters seeks you out for protection, then grant it to him, so that he may hear the word of God. Afterward, escort him to a safe place. Such things happen, because they are a people without knowledge of God. How can there be an alliance with idolaters in God's sight, and in the sight of the messenger, except for those with whom you made alliances near the sacred mosque in Mecca? As long as they stand firm in their commitment to you, do the same with them. Remember that God loves those who are attentive to him, and him alone. It goes on to essentially compel a great effort to work with people who are non-believers, to bring them into the faith. So let me ask the follow-up that I had in reading this. I had never seen the full context, and I thank you for putting it there. But my concern is that as long as there's a religion with more than a billion people, if most of the billion understand the passage in its context, not urging death on everyone, but saying, try to bring them into the fold, make them believe with you, bring them into God's love. As long as the passage exists that says, fight the idolaters wherever you find them, seize them, beset them, besiege them, wait for them in ambush, some small percentage is likely to view it in a way that says, violence is an answer for those who don't believe what I do. Do you agree that some small percentage will probably always do that?
I do agree, Kevin, that's exactly the case. And I would say that it's parallel with the way that certain lines of the Christian gospel have been used. For instance, there's a line in the Gospel of John about Jews killing Jesus and saying that our crime be on us and our children. And that line was taken, that's the Gospel of John, I believe, and it has been taken as a justification for pogroms by Christians on Jews over the centuries. And the whole question of the anti-Semitism that the Church has, if not quite promoted, but certainly condoned, really comes out of passages like that, from that very beautiful Gospel. But it does contain these very, you know, potentially poisonous passages that can be and have been read in a violent way. And so, yes, I mean, we're all guilty. I guess the thing I would say is that we're all susceptible to distorting, to ruining a beautiful thing.
Right.
It's in us to do.
And that's why the Sam Harrises and Richard Dawkins of the world, the atheist crowd, says, even if more than a billion people view it as peaceful and beautiful and loving, you're still talking about thousands of people who may use this to kill people, and that's what makes it dangerous. And again, I'm not condoning any sort of interpretation in that sense. I want everyone to read George's book, Do We Worship the Same God? I mean, in our remaining time, I'm going to tell you even more about what I appreciated in George's work. But how do we start to lessen that number even more, the number of people who would pull that out of context and use it for violence? How do we do that, George?
Well, I think we have to, you know, in the larger context, we have to look at why people, what are the social and political conditions that govern those places in the world where that's happening? Well, let's look at Syria. Let's look at Iraq. Let's look at Yemen. Let's look at Nigeria, northern part of Nigeria. They're all places of tremendous political breakdown. Why has that breakdown occurred? Who's had a hand in it? What has our role been in it? What is our role today in it? We have a very violent role in these Muslim-dominant countries right now. Could it be that we ourselves are part of the problem in the way that we've destabilized these regions? Because people, I don't think, normally, they will go to these lengths unless everything else in their life has been ruined or destroyed. There's got to be a way for us to look at the whole political, social context in which this kind of distortion occurs, because I think that's the origin of it.
We're going to get to a break here, and then we're going to get to the phones, and we're going to talk about the terms jihad, infidel, what we don't understand about them in the way that they're often reported on. Let me also say that the book, Do We Worship the Same God, is not an examination of the question of violence all the way through. I'm simply looking at modern recent news events that I think call for this kind of dialogue right now. But George's book takes us through a lot of things. You know, whether God rested on the seventh day, how interesting it is the way the Christian and Islamic faiths differ on that point. You know, the birth of Jesus itself and the voice that Mary heard and all of the different things that are similar, different, the way that we maybe can learn from different interpretations. So that's what the book is. We're looking at the questions and recent news events for a very obvious reason. I just want to make sure people understand that. George Dartis is here. Short break, your phone calls, and much more with him next on member-supported public radio. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Briefly, I welcome Michelle Faust, my colleague, for a brief word on a project you've been working on, Michelle.
That's right. There has been so many headlines in as far as healthcare is concerned over the last 24 hours. Trust me. So if you'd like to look at that, you can go to WXXI.org/ACA. For our future reporting, we're hoping to hear from you. We'd like an email, or you can take our survey at WXXI.org/ACA, or send us an email. ACAWXXI@WXXI.org. If you have any questions about health care, about the Affordable Care Act, we want to hear from you, and you may be the next person that we profile, next question and answer profiled on our project.
Thank you, Michelle. Keep reminding us of that, because we want the community to stay involved and stay engaged.
That's right. ACAWXXI@WXXI.org.
Okay. Michelle Faust joining us. Let me get to the phones, and let me start with, this is Thomas in Greece. Thomas, thanks for calling. You're on with George.
Hello.
Thomas. Yes.
Hello. Can you hear me?
I can.
Yeah. You can?
I can.
Okay. Good. Okay. You can hear me.
I can hear you,
Hello?
Thomas. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Good. I was just wanting to say, I know that there are many Christians with their preconceived notions, probably, who would probably use this latest incident of the execution of the Jordanian airmen as an excuse for denouncing Islam and saying that, you know, Christianity is so superior and everything. I mean, when you think of everything that's in them, and then I think it was Billy Graham's son, who is also a minister, who called Islam an evil religion. He did say that once, and I remember he said it on television. It's an evil religion. Now, I was wondering, it's quite recent in history when the Catholics and the Protestants were murdering each other in Northern Ireland. They went on for, that went on for decades. And then you could go back to European history with the massacre of St. Bartholomew's Day and massacre of St. Bartholomew's Day in Paris, 1572, when the Catholics set upon the attacks of Huguenots, the French Protestants, and slaughtered them. Then there was the 30 Years' War, and I know this is all centuries ago, but then there has always been this anti-Semitism, and there have been anti-Semitic incidents in Europe, and particularly in Great Britain now. So I think not entirely by Muslims, certainly by Christians, I think. And then, you know, I mean, Christians should take this into mind when they think of the word Muslim or Islam as they think of violence and they think of war. And, well, I would just like to know your guest's view about that.
Thomas, thanks for the call. Go ahead, George.
Well, Thomas, I think that you're pointing to some very sad but true facts about our human journey, that we can be a very bloody bunch of people who give no mercy to each other. And we are always looking for an excuse to turn other people into objects, and that means that eventually we will kill them. And what is behind that? I think we have to look at what the causative factors are, and I think they're often have to do with not so much of religion, but issues of power, control, and those are the real problems. And it's very hard for us to tackle those kinds of questions because they lead back to ourselves so quickly.
Jake writes to us and wants to know if George covers Coptic or Assyrian Christianity in his book.
No, I don't. I don't cover that. No, I don't.
And let me ask then about some of this terminology. We hear the term infidel. We hear in very loud, shrill, and often frightening terms that terrorists are planning to kill the infidels. Sometimes they cite the very passages we've talked about. Your book talks about what infidel means and what it does not mean. Put on your professorial hat and walk us through it a little bit.
Well, I'm a great lover of languages, Evan, and people have to bear with me here. But I just love Semitic languages. I'm talking about Hebrew and Arabic, and I've had the chance to learn a bit of both of them. In this case, with Arabic, I'm also interested in the way that a vocabulary from one world is taken into a different world. Like the vocabulary for the Quran basically comes out of the Bedouin context in which the religion originally arose. Mostly tribal situations of great internecine warfare. In fact, the Hajj in Mecca was originally, it grew up as a way to kind of help these tribes get over their internecine fighting. They were constantly doing it. Islam enters in as a way to kind of bring all people into one community, one ummah is the Arabic word, to overcome all this tribal fighting, which is just reducing people to constant warfare. So, but the Quran then takes many of the words out of this context because that's how these revealed religions work. They work with the materials of the life of the people. These are not philosophies that come down from on high in some kind of purified form. They work with what's given. So you have a word, a triliteral root in Arabic, which has the consonants KFR. And those words become the word, those three consonants become the word with vowels inside them, kafir, meaning that's the word used as infidel. Well, what does it mean? Well, it's actually, those consonant roots are actually cognate with the word cover. And what it refers to in the Bedouin time was that if you're given a gift, the worst thing you can do is to cover up the gift so as to pretend that you never got it and therefore don't have to be grateful for it to the person who gave it to you. Covering to prevent any acknowledgement of indebtedness to the person from whom the gift came.
Being ungrateful.
Being ungrateful. Yeah, and then it comes in the Quran as ungrateful. And ungrateful not simply to the person who gave you that gift, but to God who gave you the gift of life. So infidel really means somebody who denies that he is a, or she is a created being, that somehow he's his own little God and he can dictate the world the way that he wants to see it. And that to me is a very appropriate use of the word infidel. You're not faithful to the trust that God gave you that you would be faithful to your own stature. As
non-believers, though, don't necessarily view themselves as their own God.
Well, they do in that context because they're acting as if they are. That's the problem. If you believe that your life is belongs to you and you alone and everybody else is subordinate, then you get to control what everybody else is thinking.
But I think some atheists would say that's a straw man, that atheists are often very existential, that they want to leave the world a better place than they found it because they view this as the only chance.
Yeah, but I'm not talking about them. I mean,
okay, okay.
We're back in Bedouin Arabia.
Yes,
okay?
So we're not even necessarily talking about the philosophy of George Dardis. We're talking about the roots of this term.
We're talking about the roots of the term.
And the understanding of what it really means in this tradition.
So, well, we're talking about tribalism, basically, and that's, sure, that's a disease that afflicts us today.
Okay, so infidel, ungrateful for God's gift.
Yeah.
But what does the religion then say that we ought to do about infidels?
Well, they can't be trusted because they will not enter into any kind of any kind of association with you that you can be confident they'll uphold, because they're not respecting the all-embracing governing power of God to control all of us, because they're in their own little tribal world. They won't come out of it. They're only there to get what they can out of you. And we can imagine all kinds of parallels to our contemporary situation, where one little balkanized group in contemporary life fights against another little group and won't hear any truth in it. You know, one party is like the problem, what's happening in Washington right now. You've got this tribal situation of Republicans all and Tea Party people all in one place, and then Democrats and what's left of them in another, and they won't talk. That's something similar. I mean, I would use it as an analogy.
But when we hear extremists say the command is to kill the infidels, wrong.
Well, it's the command is that you try, as that passage that I tried to explicate,
yep,
in the book does, to say these people, because it all comes out of concrete situations, where what that passage from the Quran is talking about is the effort on the part of the new Muslim community to establish treaty relations with the various other tribes around Mecca at that time. And they couldn't get any kind of a stable treaty relationships with those tribes because those tribes wouldn't be faithful to them.
All of a sudden, George, every single phone line's lit up. People are now, and we're going to have to move quickly. I want to talk, but before we get to the phones, and we'll do the rest of the hour, let's also define jihad. We often allow it to be defined as simply meaning holy war.
Yeah.
When, until your book, I didn't realize that Muhammad is said to have essentially said greater jihad directed inward. Lesser jihad is a protection of a community, but you need greater jihad first. Briefly walk me through that.
Well, it's jihad comes from an Arabic word meaning to strive for what is good. And that can be taken in two different senses, at least it is in the Muslim tradition. As used in the it is that you strive both for the good of yourself, that is, for the right ordering of your own person in relation to your community and to God. And then in the larger sense, you strive to enable your own community to prosper, to flourish. Those are two kinds of strivings towards a good end. And the story about Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessing on him, is that some members of his group came back from a victorious encounter with some infidels. That is, people who had been untrustworthy, and they couldn't enter into a kind of bargaining or treaty arrangement with them. They'd had to enter into some kind of conflict. They came back, said they'd been successful, and he said, well, that's the lesser jihad. The greater jihad is the inner work, to put yourself in a position of peace with respect to all human beings, not just your own little tribe, but to all of them, and to God. And the other point I want to make about this, a discovery I made looking at the Arabic translation of the New Testament, which I found fascinating, is that the word comes up there, jihad. That is, I'm talking about the Arabic word in the Arabic version of our New Testament, it's been translated in many, many languages out of the original Greek.
Jihad in Christianity.
Yeah, it's used. And one of the places it's used in the Gospel of Luke to describe Jesus' agony in the garden. Well, that word agony is in Arabic the word jihad, that Jesus' struggle in the garden. It's also used in St. Paul's letters, whenever Paul is talking about how we have to strive for the good of our faith. That's the word that's used. So it's all over. We all own it.
Let me get to the phones. We've got to move quickly. As best you can, let's keep it brief. This is Mary Lou. Go ahead, Mary Lou.
Well, hello there. I'm calling from Geneva. I was wanting to comment on the fact that the topic was basically how is the Christian God and the Islam God perhaps similar. And I would say from the point of view of a free thinker and a non-believer, I find them both terrifying because they're both gods, and their followers don't have room for the fact that I should have a choice in my life and how to believe, and I shouldn't be tagged as an infidel. I should be based upon what I do on a day-to-day basis and how I interact with people who live in my society and participate in the community, but I don't get that option based upon these people's belief, and that is terrifying to me, and I don't care which God you want to call it, as long as you are so insecure in your religion that everyone has to believe what you believe or you're terrified to the point of crusades or jihad, I can't see really much difference.
All right, Mary Lou, thanks for the call. I've got to let George respond because we're running out of time. Go ahead, George.
Well, very briefly, Mary Lou, I don't think the Muslims I know, the Christians I know, would never react that way to you. They would say the fact that you're living that good life is really what the point is. And your belief is your relation with God, whatever it may be, whether you don't think you have one or whatever it might be. You work that out. We all have to work out our salvations in whatever way we can. But the fact that you're behaving well, that's all that is. We're going back to the comment on jihad. The fact that you're a trustworthy person, you're a good person, you're doing what's best for your community, you would be not a unbeliever at all. You would not be an infidel at all. You would be just the opposite of that.
Dan in Brighton. Go ahead, Dan.
Hi. What bothers me about Islam is that it's a religion of domination. It always talks about governing, and whereas Christianity said, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's and unto God what is God's, which many people interpret as staying out of the government or at least not imposing the religion on the government.
All right, I've got to let George respond. Religion of domination versus Christianity not? Yes or no?
Oh, well, I'm sorry. I can't go along with that. It's the question is so much more difficult than that. Islam really is, like Christianity, it is a answer to the human cry for help. And Muslims appeal to God, Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. And the God, the benevolent and the merciful. Both Muslims and Christians are Jews as well, and the people of other religions are basically saying, help. I need help. I can't get through this life without divine guidance. And these religions give us that and through love and through beauty.
Tony in Geneseo. Go ahead, Tony.
Yes, I think actually your guest's representation is not really all that accurate. Both the Catholic Church and Islam oppress women. And so the previous caller was right on. I mean, you may know people or Christians that have a different point of view, but I mean, look what's going on in Saudi Arabia. So I'd like to get the speaker's comments on the oppression of women by Islam and how that's connected to violence in society.
Tony, thanks for the call. George?
Well, Tony, very briefly, I know lots of... It depends on where you are, where you're talking about. Saudi Arabia is it's almost as terrible a travesty of Islam as ISIS is. Women are oppressed there, no question of it. But if you look at other Muslim countries, you don't see that. And if you look at the way Muslim women are treated in this country, the important roles they play, you would not say that at all. I think the big problem we all have is that the one I originally had, I don't know any Muslims. I never talked to them. But once you do know them, once
going,
you
going back
part
to
of
1991,
world,
George is saying.
Yeah,
right.
Going back to that. Yeah. That, you know, with all these sort of very simple dichotomies just break down very quickly.
So you get the sense of these ideas of some of the subjects of the phone calls we're having here would melt away if we reach out.
You can. I can tell people exactly how to do it. But you have to make the effort. But I know it's hard. I began the hour by saying how hard it was for me. I had to overcome a lot of prejudice and inertia and fear. And the media does nothing to help us here. But it can be done. I can tell people how to do it.
George, the book is called Do We Worship the Same God? Comparing the Bible and the Quran. That's one of several. You and your wife have a book on the artistic side of things. There's just so much out there that George has been working on that I would encourage you. Dardess is the last name, D-A-R-D-E-S-S. And what I also find, George, is that we didn't get through anywhere close to the volume of calls that came in, so you may have to come back sometime soon. Can I invite you back sometime
soon? You may, Evan.
Maybe with Dr. Shafiq and a number of others here.
Oh, great.
All right. Yeah. George Dardess, our guest for the hour. Short break, and his friend Jack Garner's here. We're talking movies next. Stay with us.